Hi, everybody. We want to thank our sponsor, Legion M. They are a wonderful company. We love working with them. You can go to their website, Legion M. They're also on all the various socials. They do really fun meetups. You can talk to directors. You can become a part of the projects they choose. They even have a program right now where you can help them find great movies to support. So go to their website to learn more. We also want to remind you that we have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies.
Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
You're listening to Maltin on Movies. And if you are a movie buff, a real movie buff, then you enjoy not just watching movies, but talking about them and hearing about them from friends and reading about them. And that involves reading books. I know this may be an antiquated pursuit, but I still pursue it.
What is a book?
Yes. Well, let's not get into that too deep. But on the surface of it, a book is something you take off of a shelf.
What's a shelf?
From which you then return it to the shelf when you're done. And if it's a really good book, you may take it off the shelf more than once.
Ooh.
You may even consult it in years to come.
Ooh.
When you're trying to look something up. Anyway, this is a long-winded way of introducing our guest today, an old friend, Scott Eyman, who has written a number of wonderful books. I don't use that term inadvisedly. He writes great books. And his latest is called Cary Grant, A Perfect Disguise. And it is a biography of Cary Grant. Surprise, surprise. Scott, welcome.
Thanks, Leonard. Good to see you, pal.
Same here. We are talking to you from your home in Palm Beach, Florida.
West Palm Beach.
West Palm Beach. I beg your pardon.
We don't live with the swells. We live with the common people.
That's good. Because you've kept the common touch.
It's the least I can do.
This is the latest in a fairly long line of biographies that you've written. And I want to talk not just about the new one, Cary Grant, which is getting a lot of great press, and deservedly so, but about the art and the craft of writing biography in general. And is there a generalization to be made at the very top of this?
About
writing a biography. See, I've never done that. I've written a number of books.
Right.
But I've never. You
have?
And I've never tackled a solo biography focusing on one person, birth to grave. Yeah.
Though you do collect them.
Yeah.
Many, many, many.
Well, I can tell you that it's gotten a little harder than it was 30 years ago when I started doing it. And I've gotten a little softer in the process. When I started out writing books, there were still people above ground to talk to. You know, about the period I wanted to write about, the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. Most of them now are below ground, to be honest. So it's become less a matter of figuring out how to get in touch with the person that you want to talk to than it is a figure. It's more of a library issue, an oral history issue, a primary research tools, letters, things like that, than it was 30 years ago. And that's just, there's an upside to that and there's a downside to that. I mean, people are still writing books about Abraham Lincoln, and he's been dead for quite some time. And they come up with different angles and different ways to sift the material. And occasionally there's actually a new approach or some new documents that show up. Mm-hmm. So I console myself with the idea that it may come down to the point in a few years where I feel like I'm writing books about Abraham Lincoln, because it's strictly the document hunt rather than the people hunt.
Yeah.
But in my experience, the best part of it was the people. The best part of it was in generally not stars on an equivalent level or directors that I was writing about. The best stuff would come from cameramen or sure. costume people, or people mm-hmm. whose egos were not invested necessarily in their daily experience, if you know what I mean. They saw things with more clarity than actors usually do. Not to slam actors, but you know, I think you know what I'm speaking about. And those were the people that I always found the most valuable to interview. So in terms of Cary Grant, the stuff that really proved most valuable were some letters from people like Betsy Drake that I found in other collections.
An actress who was at one time married to him.
His third wife. And surprisingly enough, some actual live people, especially Walt Odets, the son of Clifford Odets, who knew Grant as an adolescent and young man, and became a psychologist in later life. So he was able to look at Grant from two perspectives, that of a kid whose father was close friends with Cary Grant, and that of a professional looking back on an interesting psychological case.
Well, let's talk just a little about that psychology of Cary Grant. You chose, I think, a particularly intriguing and apt title for this book, Cary Grant, A Perfect Disguise.
Brilliant.
Please explain. Brilliant disguise.
Brilliant.
Even better than perfect. It's brilliant.
Well, because in the era in which he became a star and continued his stardom, the construction of a persona was essentially crucial for maintaining a starring career. Clark Gable essentially played the same part for 30 years. You know, kind of cocksure. Women wanted to be with him. Men wanted to be like him. And that there weren't a lot of variations within that. He stayed within a certain narrow framework. That was the norm. Grant did something of the same, but he had a wider skill set and would occasionally display it. You know, there was more there, and he was never just one thing as an actor. You could see hints of darkness in comedy when he was playing comedy, and you could see often hints of humor when he was playing drama. So he was able to incorporate different colors into his performances in a way that made him stand out from the run-of-the-mill leading man of the period. At the same time, Cary Grant was a performance. Cary Grant was not who he was one-to-one. There were certain overlapping characteristics, but it was more of a performance, for instance, than I think Clark Gable's screen persona was a performance. I think that mm-hmm. was more of an authentic projection of who Gable was. But Grant had to navigate the difference between art. This was considerable. It grew closer over time, but there was still a gap because people always expected to see Cary Grant. And he could flip it on and off at will. But there was a constant struggle because he realized that people expected Cary Grant. They really didn't want to see Archie Leach. And a couple times in his course of his career, he basically gave them Archie Leach. And those couple times, nobody was particularly interested. So he understood that the expectations, the public's expectations were one thing. And he needed the public because success was very important to him in terms of escaping from a childhood that could fairly be termed miserable. So there was an intrinsic tension between the internal Cary Grant and the external Cary Grant. The internal Cary Grant wanted things that the external Cary Grant already had.
Including the approval of his mother.
Exactly. Exactly. The Cary Grant the audience knew, the creature in the movies, didn't seem to have any problems with women whatsoever. Mothers, wives, girlfriends, that really didn't come into it. The real Cary Grant off-screen had terrible problems with his mother. And his wives, most of them.
I do love just a little bit that Cary Grant is all of us and could never make his mother happy.
Exactly.
There is something very human in that.
Exactly.
Knowing that we are universally the same.
But I think he would have created a lot of success for the ability to make a real human contact with his mother.
Sure. Mm. So, I mean, that's...
Stars, they're just like us.
Yeah, right. That, you know, the word disguise is so real. And obviously, you know, if you're somebody like me, where you've grown up watching him because your parents and all of their friends love him, they're almost not human. Mm-hmm. You know, who is Cary Grant? He's this beautiful, graceful man who appears on screen, and he's funny and he's charismatic and he's everything. Right. You know, if you ask someone to describe sort of the perfect, it's like, there he is. You know, he's everything you want there, but he's a person. And that is what makes these biographies so vital, because it brings the rest of them to life, but it's also just fascinating to learn.
But think of the burden.
Oh, I can't even.
Think of the burden of being someone like Cary Grant.
Of course.
Where they expect you to be outfitted like you're in To Catch a Thief.
Right.
They expect you to behave like you're in North by Northwest, where he never breaks a sweat until the point at which a crop dusting plane comes down.
Right, until he has to jump.
The
plane, yes.
Dakota. But think of having to play that part 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
To an audience that expected you to play that part 24
right.
hours. Mm-hmm. In a way that a modern audience, I don't think, does.
Though even now, I mean, that's the reality, is even now there are certain people that we feel are perfect. And that, I will say, the only good thing, social media and internet in general are, you know, they have their good points and their terrible points, but I think it does help people to see someone without makeup, mm-hmm. to see someone in pajamas, to see someone doing something very normal, just because it reminds you that they don't look like they do on a red carpet 24/7. Now, what I want to know, Scott, is how you got into doing all of this.
Cary Grant or the whole thing?
The whole thing. How did you start writing?
Well, I started writing in junior high school. But mm-hmm. I mean, I was a journalist. Mm-hmm. But I realized at a certain point, I was in my 20s at this point, late 20s at this point, that if I didn't raise the bar for myself and make more demands on myself and get the level of my game up, I was going to be an alcoholic and 4 or 5 years, because I was bored, basically. So, okay, what's the next step up? Well, okay, books are the next step up. That's logical. And I was I was crazy about movies. Okay. So I decided I wanted to write a book about silent films somehow. So I made a short list. There were 6 or 7 names in the list of silent movie people that I thought needed a book that nobody had written. And let's see, there was William S. Hart. There was Jean Renoir. There was Mary Pickford. There were a few other names, you know. And Thomas Ince was on the list. And I went with Pickford because the films were more accessible than you could. I could go to the Library of Congress and see an awful lot of stuff. Whereas the Ince stuff was harder to find. Renoir, I'd have to go to. Of course, in the period we're talking about, you had to travel to see films, you know.
Yes, you had to go. You had to go to the Library of Congress,
exactly,
in Washington D.C.
Right,
make the trip.
When I wrote my book on Lubitsch, Ernst Lubitsch, I spent 2 weeks in Munich watching Lubitsch's German films. Mm-hmm. Today, if I wanted to write the exact same book, I don't have to leave my house, because right. every single film I went to Germany to see is available on disc or streaming or one avenue or another. Every one. Now, that's in 20 odd years that change has occurred. So it's easier now in one sense to do research. But as the flip side, of course, is that there's nobody to talk to, or very few people to talk to. So I did a proposal for Pickford. I had an agent. She couldn't sell the book. 6 months went by, 9 months went by. She couldn't. Every publisher in New York turned the book down. So I'm still bored. I'm still restless. So I decided to go ahead and write the book anyway and just finance it myself. So I did it. I took a week and I went to LA. I took another week and went to the Library of Congress and watched movies. And I was halfway through the book, writing the book, when she sold the book to a character named Donald I. Fine, who was famous in the publishing world for 2 things, for being incredibly temperamental and cheap, and for discovering Elmore Leonard. And he told me, I went to New York to talk to him, and I went in his office, and he was screaming at the top of his lungs to somebody on the telephone using dialogue that would only be, I hear, repeated in Full Metal Jacket. And it was quite impressive from a verbal point of view. I mean, he didn't repeat himself once, and he was going on and on. And finally, the phone slams down, and secretary leans over and says, he'll see you now. And so I went in and he proceeded to tell me the only reason he bought the book was because the first movie he ever saw was Sparrows with Mary Pickford and his mother had taken it. And okay, so I finished the book. He published it. It earned out in about 2 months because he only paid me a tiny amount of money. But it got a great review in People magazine. And that's all it took. And I was off and running. So that's basically the Cliff's Notes version. But it was out of a thwarted ambition and a desire to stretch my talent as far as it go. And before you know it, I hacked out a neat niche for myself. That's it.
How old were you when you published your first book?
32, 31, mm-hmm. 32.
And when did you guys meet?
Oh, 18.
Yeah, in our teens.
We're the same age. We're the same age. He yeah. was with two men I admired, Herb Graff and Al Greenberg. I believe it was Rochester. Was it the Rochester Cinecon?
Could well have been.
Oh, it might have been, or Syracuse, or one of them. And I had already read Film Fan Monthly. And I felt like I was a kid looking at Lou Gehrig, you know, because he was publishing and he was hanging out with adults and he was interviewing movie stars and we're the same age and I still had pimples and he was already Leonard Maltin because he's never changed. That's the funny thing. He's precisely the same guy now that he was 50 years ago. And nobody believes that, but he's the same guy. His head never got any bigger and it never got any smaller. He's Leonard. He's Leonard. I love that about him.
That's why we keep him around.
Please do. Keep it. Yeah. Keep him around.
Now I have to, you just mentioned Herb Graff and we do have to, but for a moment,
yes.
Thank him because without him, I would not exist.
Really? Oh, he was the
connection. Introduced my parents. So Herb is the reason that I'm a person and I'm very grateful to him for that.
As you should be. As you
and, should be. And
Herb,
you know, when
Herb was funny,
very funny.
Yes.
Very funny. He, you know, there's a handful of names that when they come up, I always feel like we need to pay just a bit of homage to them.
Sure.
And Herb is one of them. And Herb was such an incredibly special man. And he gathered up these cinephiles who otherwise would probably have been alone in their basements and put them together in a basement so that they could learn to make friends.
You're right. But the thing I admired about your dad and Leonard, I mean, your dad and Al and Herb and that group is they were all men in full. They had lives, you know? And I, even at that early stage of my life, I knew I didn't want to spend my life in a dark room and know who was the stuntman on a Richard Talmadge serial from 1931. But not have any relationships that went deeper than that. You know, I wanted to have the whole thing and like Herb did, like Al did, like your dad does. And that was always a goal of mine. It was always a goal of mine.
Well, you like I have been happily married for a long, long time.
Forever. 34 long, hard years.
How did you and Lynn meet?
Where did we meet? We met at a newspaper. We met at the Fort Lauderdale Sun Sentinel, New Sun Sentinel, in 1983 when I moved down there to take a job because I needed a gig. And my first book was either just about, I was just about to hit. It was just about to come out. And I just saw her walking across the city room and I thought, that is the cutest thing I've seen in a year. So I asked her out and she said no. And I said, okay, well, that's fine. So I started writing stories and she started sending me compliments about the stories I was writing and I ignored them because I'd asked her out and she said no.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I could take no for an answer. So she continued sending me compliments and stopping by and saying hi. And I knew I had her, but I was going to reel her in. Little humiliation never hurt anybody. She agreed to, she said she'd have lunch with me. And I said, I don't do lunch. I was going to make her go out to dinner with me, you know? So finally she actually, what I said was, if I promise not to leave any bruises or visible indentations, would you go out with me? And for some reason, she seemed startled and alarmed by that. But eventually she did go out with me, and I closed the deal shortly thereafter.
And the rest,
as they say, is history. Man, oh.
And then, so then you continue to work side by side as fellow.
Yeah, and I just kept writing books on the side. As I told people, journalism was my wife and books were my mistress.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, in all honesty, I put a little bit more emphasis on the mistress part than I did on the wife part, but not when it came to Lynn. Right? Right?
Right?
Right?
Yes, dear. Yes, dear.
Yes, dear.
But see, you know, people who know us will say everybody needs an Alice. Like, you have a Lynn. Everybody needs. And exactly for what you're saying is because it gives you that full life.
Yeah.
And as lovely as it is, we were talking about before we started recording that you're mentioned in Parade magazine, that this Cary Grant book is mentioned there. And that's lovely. But if you don't have someone special to celebrate these things with, you know, it's tough. That's the joy of it, is getting to go to someone. My dad always says his favorite person to watch movies with is my mom. Yeah. I think it's a lie, but it's nice that he says it. And, you know,
it seems at the time he says that he's very sincere.
Indeed. Oh, indeed. Indeed. And most importantly, I'm sure there's something that you know. It's not just that my dad is wrong.
No, you did it backwards.
No. It's not just that you are wrong. It's that my mother is right.
Exactly.
These are the
keys. It's not enough that your mother be right. She has to be extremely right.
Accurate. So you've met my mother.
Just a little. A few times. I'd write about her and call her my most unforgettable character, but I think it's been done.
Man, Alice Malton, she is a tiny, tiny ball of fury and magic. That's why we love her.
True.
So, Scott, I heard years and years ago that I won't use names here to protect the guilty, about a very well-known writer on film subjects who decided to do a major biography of a very important figure from old Hollywood. And he did. And by the time he had completed researching and writing the book, he hated the man, absolutely hated the man, and regretted that he had devoted so many years to this pursuit. I mean, he was glad he completed the book, mm-hmm. but it gave him no pleasure. Mm-hmm. And that goes along with that old saying that no man is a hero to his valet.
Right.
And have you found yourself in that situation ever?
Not really. The closest I ever got was spending 6 years with John Ford to write the book. 6 years, because to me he was the white whale of America.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The Moby Dick of American movies, and I fancied myself as Ahab without the harpoon. And I told my wife, I said, spending 6 years with John Ford is being like being locked in a phone booth with the worst Irish drunk you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
That said, when it got too claustrophobic in that phone booth, I watched the movies.
Mm-hmm.
Because
yeah.
Ford is one of those artists who put his best life into his work, and there wasn't much left over for wives and children and friends. You know, it all went into his work. All the compassion and the affection and the love kind of went into his work. And I would, when it got too claustrophobic, I would watch Ford movies, and that got me back on track, because that was, I had to include both sides of the thing. But what kept me going was the beauty of the art. But I'm not one of those people that would write spend 15 years writing 2 volumes about Joseph Goebbels. I mean, I just wouldn't do it. There are people that do that, and I'm glad for them. I don't want to do it, and I don't particularly want to read that book either.
Mm.
But I tend to circle someone a while and do some preliminary research before I commit to doing a book, because especially now when it's a different transaction, because I'm older now. Mm. And I don't know how many more books I've got in me, because things can go south. So I always ask myself, is this worth 3 or 4 years of my fast ebbing life to spend 3 or 4 of those years doing this book? And sometimes the answer is yes. And there have been a couple of times when I thought, no, not really. not really. I didn't feel it. I wasn't feeling it, you know?
Mm-hmm. I think that's so very wise.
You move on to the other, to something else, or you wait a couple months for someone to suggest something that you haven't actually thought of,
yeah.
You know? And that's happened too. And that's happened. I've had people say, why not do that? And 2 weeks later, I'm working on an outline. Mm. So I take my ideas and where I can get them, basically.
And yet you tackled Ford, I thought, very fairly and very thoroughly. It must have been tough. It must have been tough to deal with that, because he was so ridiculously contrary.
Uh-huh.
He was a contrarian, if nothing else. He was a great artist, but a contrarian.
As contrarian to perversity.
Mm-hmm.
Not sexually, but psychologically.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that, I'd never dealt with anybody like that before, really,
mm-hmm.
or since.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the people I've written about had great clarity of character, like Lubitsch or John Wayne. You mm-hmm. know, take him or leave him, he was consistent in respects throughout his life.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't really alter that much, or success didn't alter him that much.
Mm-hmm.
But Ford, you couldn't say that about. And Grant had his own issues, you know, because the Grant that people saw on screen was not the Grant that the crew saw when they were mm-hmm. making a movie. The Grant mm-hmm. the crew saw was nervous and anxious and something of a pain, actually, you know, worried about the sound, worried about the lights, worried about the script, especially the script. Every time he signed to do it, not every time, but a lot of the times he would sign to do a movie and immediately regret signing them for the movie and want to get out of it, because whatever he'd seen in the script the first or second time he read it had vanished after he signed the contract, you know, and he just had all these doubts. He was full of doubts, and the doubts tended to overrule his initial enthusiasm for a project mm-hmm. later on in the project. All during North by Northwest, he was complaining that there was nothing there. The script, there was no there in the script. And it's true. On the page, I can see why North by Northwest wouldn't look like much, you know. On the other hand, Hitchcock standing there directing the picture, you've got to be, and they'd worked together before, and he'd seen that Hitchcock could spin gold from straw, really. But he still would have his frets, and it's not a Cary Grant picture, he would say. It's a David Niven picture, which is kind of an interesting backhanded way of looking. Mm-hmm. But I get his meaning. It's not true, because David Niven never got lucky enough to work for Hitchcock.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but he had his doubts, and he could be pettish and demanding and on one day, and then he'd be perfectly fine and, you know, almost apologetic. And then the next day he'd be demanding and pettish again.
Mm-hmm.
That was just the way he was.
Mm-hmm. Now, what I wonder, again, I haven't experienced this. When, if ever, do you feel in the process of doing this research and writing, when do you feel, okay, I've got it? I've figured this person out. I've got it. I just read, again, no names. I just read what I would call a workmanlike biography of a fairly well-known actor. And
dead or alive?
Dead, mm-hmm. which is significant in what I'm about to say, I think.
Right.
And this author did, who I'm not familiar with, did a workmanlike job.
Right.
Got all the facts, was able to talk to some close relatives and some colleagues.
Right.
Though, you know, largely it's a research job done from clippings in libraries, you know, but he did the best he could. And I never felt that I got to know the guy.
Mm-hmm.
I never got that feeling, which is what you want from a good biography.
Right.
And which you do provide in your books. When is there a turning point? Is there and is it predictable when that turning point will occur?
I know it when I get it.
Mm-hmm.
My goal, the thing in the back of my head that I try to do with all of my books is to make the dead walk again.
Mm-hmm.
My goal is, if you read one of my biographies or one of my books, and that person rose from Forest Lawn and came to your house and sat down in the living room, you could have a conversation with them, because you'd know what they ate, what kind of aftershave they used, what they thought of their second wife and possibly the third wife, how they voted, liberal, Democrat, conservative, Republican, whatever, all these incremental qualities that go into personality, you know, and that you would understand that person and had a working knowledge enough to have a conversation with them if they walked into your room. That's the image I have in my head of what I'm trying to accomplish. Mm-hmm. And there's usually a point when I feel, sometimes it's just something somebody tells me, like talking to Waldo Detz about Grant. And when I looked at the transcript, I thought, that's the heart of the man. That's him. That's the guy. That's the guy that could flip the switch and become Cary Grant at will, but had terrible insecurities when he stopped flipping the switch and he was just sitting in the room alone. That's the guy. Other times it's incremental and it comes out of a, like a, because a biography is like a movie in a sense, in that it's a mosaic. You've got all, a movie is composed of hundreds of shots that are spliced together, and you add music and you add, you know, post-production, and hopefully it blends together into one overriding image, picture, emotion. A book's like that, except it's more obviously a montage, a collage of hundreds and hundreds of fragments, of factoids, of newspaper clippings, of interview transcripts, of watching movies, of going over financial records and contracts, all these things. But they have to be blended together in a narrative. Mm. And I pride myself, perhaps foolishly, on my ability to create narrative, where the pages turn themselves. And then you're not necessarily conscious of the effort that's being expended on my part or the effort that's being expended on the reader's part. That it, there's a flow, it flows. So I think of it in the same way that I think of a director making a successful movie. You're not conscious of the minutes flicking by as you're watching a good movie. You're just conscious of the story. And that's what I try to do. But to answer the question, yeah, generally speaking, I'm conscious of when I get that picture in my own mind. And I'm also conscious, for instance, it came to the point where I had a rough draft of the Grant book and I didn't think I had him. And the book is, at that point, was like 460 pages long, 480 maybe. And I wasn't happy with it. I just didn't have it. And I knew I didn't have it and I didn't know what to do. So I started making phone calls. I started making phone calls and I got a couple of interviews from people that I didn't know were alive. And that gave me a feeling of security that I had him, that I had, because there was more density there. There was more depth of field, if you will, mm-hmm. more depth mm-hmm. of field. And that, and maybe I would just talk to myself in a neurotic state of doubt, but those couple of extra interviews I did very close to finishing the book gave me more of a feeling of security than I had before.
Hmm. Interesting. One of the things I admire about your John Wayne book, which called John Wayne, The Life and Legend, is that you are very fair-minded. Mm-hmm. I think I said that before, mm-hmm. in dealing with him. Now, he's come up in the news recently because people have yet again, happens periodically.
Every five years.
People have discovered and blabbed about this interview he gave to Playboy some decades ago, where he seems really, put it mildly, unenlightened.
Yeah.
About people of whose skin color is not the same as his. Mm-hmm. And, but that wasn't him, was it? It's not that he didn't say that. And it's not that he
said it. No question. He said it. No, he was one of those people. I grew up with people like him. I grew up with people that were born in 1900, 1903. My grandfather was born around the same time John Wayne was. And he was not much like John Wayne, except in certain aspects. But Wayne would talk about people in generalities. And anytime you talk about races and religions in generalities, you can hear ice cracking under your feet.
Mm-hmm.
The thing of it was, he didn't treat individuals like that. He was bloviating about blacks and Indians, and as if he'd never actually met any, in the kind of his theoretical through the lens of theoretical conservatism. On the ground, working as an actor in the business for almost 50 years, he didn't treat people like that. He didn't, he wouldn't have thought of treating people like that because he met people as individuals. And you have to make that clear that there's a difference between what people do, talk in theory, and how they actually act on the ground in action, mm-hmm. you know?
And it was the same with people he met or encountered or even worked with who didn't share his political outlook.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
He took each one on its own terms.
Yeah. Well, I mean, take me, for example. I spent 90 minutes with him in a room alone. And I was 21 years old and I had zero credentials. I had nothing to my name. I was just a kid who wanted to be a writer about the movies. And as far as he was concerned, I could have been with, he couldn't have treated me any better if I was with the New York Times. As a matter of fact, he probably treated me better than he would have with someone from the New York Times. But he was great. He was absolutely great. He considered my questions serious. I asked him a couple good questions, a couple dumb questions, but he took me seriously. He took the questions seriously. He took his answers seriously. Now, class is how you treat people when no one's looking.
Yeah.
You know? And no one was looking when he was in the room with me. He could have blown me off or gotten angry and thrown me out of the room. But no, we actually had a conversation. We had a conversation about the movies. Now, I wasn't asking him about cancer. I wasn't asking him about racial politics. I wasn't asking about those things I didn't bring up liberal politics. I never touched any of his hot points. We were talking about how John Ford ran a set. We were talking about Henry Hathaway. We were talking about Bill Wellman. We were talking about all these people that mentored him. And we talked about Nat Levine. I'm sure nobody had asked him about Nat Levine in 30 years.
Founder of Mascot Pictures.
Mascot Pictures, where he started out doing serials for $750. Not $750 a week, $750 for the entire movie. So in a sense, I was on safe ground, but I didn't know I was on safe ground. I was just curious to hear about these things.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So he opened himself up completely and very specifically and very intelligently. And he thought about his answers and he thought about the questions. And we had an actual conversation. John Wayne and a 21-year-old kid from Ohio with no credentials. So he got some points. And he gets some points in retrospect, too, for that. Because I don't think there are too many modern stars or stars of any generation who would be that open to that level of detailed exchange with a writer who didn't mean a thing to them or to mm-hmm. the public at large.
But you knew how to handle yourself too. Give yourself some credit there. And you knew the right questions to ask.
Okay.
All right. I'll do it for you. There you go.
Thank you. Okay. Take it.
Now, as in most instances, when you start on a subject, the person you're going to devote years to writing about, you're looking for research. You're looking for background information. You're looking for details of all sorts. When you took on Cecil B. DeMille for your book on him, you had the opposite situation.
Right.
You had an archive which was deposited at Brigham Young University, which took up an entire building where there was an avalanche, a tsunami of facts and details. How did you deal with that? How did you winnow through all that?
Well, I'd been thinking about DeMille ever since I was a kid when I saw the Ten Commandments. And I think I always thought, I mean, he's completely out of style. And well, I don't think that's going to change any. Because his best work was done in the silent era, and not enough people see the silent DeMille. But I always thought he was a hugely talented director in his early days, and I have a great affection for a lot of the later stuff as well. But I also thought he was a primary figure in the formation of the American movie industry. So DeMille being DeMille, he kept every piece of paper he ever scribbled on. He kept phone numbers. He kept doodles. Everything. It's all there. His parents' love letters are there. So it was a very easy book to write for me because I've been thinking about him for decades and I had a profusion of material and I thought, you know, this is really, I could do a 2-volume book here. I really could. And I could have, but I couldn't have sold a 2-volume book. And I had to honestly ask myself, does the world want two volumes in Cecil B. DeMille? And I thought, no, even I don't know whether I want to read two volumes in Cecil. So I kept it to one volume. That book was fairly easy of me to, and in all honesty, because the thing about writing books, these kinds of books, is that you often feel a vague sense of disappointment because the book in your head never quite matches up with the book that you end up with for all sorts of reasons. Sometimes it's material. Sometimes it's because you discover things you didn't know you were going to discover. You usually don't, but the DeMille book, the DeMille book I wanted to write matched up very nicely with the DeMille book that I actually wrote. So I had a sense of kind of completion about that book that I don't often have. But what I have to keep reminding myself is that whether it's a book or a movie or a biography or a painting, in the process, the work changes. By doing that thing, the work takes on a life of its own and a maturation process of its own. So you often end up at a different destination than you thought you would. Hmm. So you have to be able to roll with that and accept that, you know? But I only figured that out in the doing of it, in writing 15 books. You come to that realization. But the DeMille book is a book that I actually ended up pretty much where I wanted to end up and told the story I had to tell.
The book I was waiting for years, because I too have had a lifelong fascination with DeMille, and other people did write books about him, and they were never terribly good.
Yeah.
And they all fell short of my, not only expectations, but my demands. Mm. And now I'm tempted, though I'm compulsive, I've been tempted to take all those other books and just discard them, because your book does the job so thoroughly.
Oh, thanks. That's nice to know.
And entertainingly, too, because he was an entertaining man.
Oh, God. Never had a dull moment in his life, I don't think.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was the straw that stirred the drink. He was a fascinating guy. I adored him. I'm sorry I never got a chance to meet him.
Mm. Like you say,
I would like to have met.
People always ask him, they always say, you know, who would you have loved to have met? And there's obvious Walt Disney, you know, there's people that are obvious in that, but it really, I mean, the thing, the magic of a book is exactly what you're talking about. And it's making someone three-dimensional again.
Yeah.
And, you know, and in that you need to tell both sides. You can't make them perfect. Because that isn't real. At the same time, I do think it's really important, and someone like you cares about this, you know, you don't want to take away from achievements.
Well, no. I mean, I remember when I was writing the Wayne book,
mm-hmm.
and I came, and you know, I had to deal with the Playboy interview, which is what we're talking about. And I said, oh, how do I handle this? What do I do with this? You know, I can't avoid it. I shouldn't avoid it. But it took me a while to figure out how to deal with it.
Sure.
And I dealt with it basically by excerpting the more outrageous parts of the interview and then pointing out what I pointed out to you guys, that he was speaking, bloviating, you know, as if he's talking to a group of boys around the fireplace with cigars and brandy.
Yep. Yeah.
You know, and they're all going, yeah, you're right, Duke. Absolutely right, Duke. But he didn't treat people like that. He didn't treat Woody Strode that way or any of the other blacks or gays or Indians that he worked with. He treated them very well because mm-hmm. he knew them as individuals and he responded to them as individuals.
Yeah.
And
but that's what I mean. It makes a person human. You're able to, you know, you don't want to pretend like certain things didn't happen.
No, you can't.
But you can also look at it in a human way and say, all right, here's what this was. But let's look at the reality of the situation.
Sure. But you got to avoid feeling protective about
of yourself, course,
you know, and I had to pull back from that. Not so much with the Wayne, but that has come up a couple times where I was going to run him some slack. No, because what Wayne would have said is put it in with that gesture, you know, put it in, you know, because he wasn't ashamed of anything he ever did or said. Well, he was ashamed of some things he did. That's not true. But I don't think he was ashamed of any of his political or social opinions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He was ashamed of certain things he did, but that wasn't for public consumption.
Yeah, but again, it's human. It would be strange if you wrote a book about somebody and left out every time they did something untoward. I mean, and any number of things, and it can even be the people who everyone loves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's always going to be a moment, and if you don't include that, then you're not really telling their story.
Yeah, but the problem is in modern culture, we often judge people by their worst moment.
Oh, I know.
You know. Some stupid reference on Facebook or some slighting email or whatever, but just any public slip and you get nailed to the cross. So you often find yourself reading things two and three times before you get sent.
Yeah.
Which is probably not the worst idea in the world anyway.
No.
But that's strictly a product of digital culture.
Yeah.
And the kind of reflexive censoriousness, where everybody feels they're on sort of a jury duty to declare other people guilty as charged.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Well,
you've had experience that few people have had, and few people that I know have had, which is you've also worked with a movie star, Robert Wagner, in writing three separate books, which carry your joint byline. How did that come about?
Fluke. There was a guy I knew in Palm Beach named Ted Bell, writer. He wrote novels. And he's no longer in Palm Beach, but he's in California now. And he would spend time in Aspen with his wife, where they met RJ and Jill St. John, RJ's wife. And he was at a party with RJ and... somehow or another, Palm Beach came up and RJ mentioned my name, and Ted didn't know where he knew him from. And RJ said, I'm reading a book of his about Louis B. Mayer. And he said, I knew Mayer's daughters. I knew Edie and I knew Irene. And usually, he said to Ted, when you read a book about people you know, you don't recognize them. He said, he gets everybody right. The people he writes about are the same people I knew. And that's remarkable. And if I was going to get somebody to write a book with, it would be him, because RJ reads a lot. And so Ted came back to Palm Beach and called me and he said, would you be interested in talking to Robert Wagner about doing a book? And I'd never thought about doing a as told to collaboration before, because I'd written 7 or 8 books, maybe 9 of my own, and it just never occurred to me. I said, of course, you know, happy to. So we talked on the phone and he came to Palm Beach. And we went to lunch at Charlie's Crab, now closed. And the first thing he did was pull out a picture of his German Shepherd named Larry after Olivier. And then I responded by pulling a picture of my German Shepherd named Cooper after Gary Cooper out of my wallet. And we traded stories about our German Shepherds. And we knew we were going to work together very well after that, because we're both passionate about dogs and animals and our wives, and we set to work on the first book, his memoir, and it was very comfortable from the beginning. You know, and I told him up front, I think, how am I going to do this? And I thought about it, and I told him, I said, look, this is your book. I'm going to tell your story the way you want it. I will only argue with you if I think you are hurting your book. If I think you're hurting your book, I will go to the mat to talk you out of it. Okay? You got to remember that. That if I start throwing up flares, I'm not doing it out of my ego. I'm doing it because it's going to make the book worse. And he said, okay, I'll remember that. And we never really had an argument over 9 or 10 years of working together and 3 books. Never had an argument. And I only really had to throw up flares once or twice. It was a very smooth process, and we've stayed close. We go out to visit them in Aspen. You know, we were going to go this summer, but COVID got in the way. And we're still very close. We're still very close. He's a dear man. He just turned 90 earlier this year.
No, that does not compute.
Well, believe me, if you spend time with him, we got him out to Lone Pine a year before. Was it 19? It was 19, fall of 19, and in October. And he talked about Broken Land. And we showed True Story of Jesse James and his Westerns in there. And man, when the lights hit him, he's on, you know, and you don't have to take, you don't have to make allowances for his age. He's in great shape. He's all, still working, still, he was supposed to do an NCIS episode in the summer, and then COVID got really ugly and they shut down production. So he's raring, he's just waiting for the callback now that they're shooting again.
He's been a recurring character on that, hasn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And he was playing the father of Michael Weatherly. And I figured, well, when Weatherly went to do his own show, well, that would be it. No, they loved him so much, they keep writing parts for him. Even though Weatherly's gone and they refer to him. How's, you know, he talks, there's a line to explain, you know, that the guy,
Weatherly. Why you're back, yeah.
Something, you know? And then they go on having fun with RJ because everybody's, he's a joy to be around. Mm. And he's a pro and he loves the work and he loves to work. And they treat him, I mean, they put down a red carpet for him, as they should. As they
good,
should.
He's, yes.
He's been a movie star since 1948, for God's sake.
And he's the only one on that set who can refer to David McCallum as kid.
Kid, right. Or Mark Harmon. Yeah, right, you're right.
Man. But as you said, that's the thing. You know, the people that are still around from a certain time,
yeah.
That's why... You know, you treasure them. That's why you ask a million questions, because the people who will have those firsthand, real firsthand experiences, you know, at a certain point, they're gone.
Absolutely.
And then what? And then you read, which is great. And there are a lot of people, you know, who make it their life's work to archive as much as possible. And that's all. Very important, but nothing is like getting to go to someone and say, tell me about this. Yeah. Tell me what this was like. Tell me what it looked like, what it sounded like. You know, they're precious.
I've been very lucky. When you're in the process of doing it, when you're, you know, putting a book together and then you go on to the next book, it's like making a movie and then you make another movie and then you make another movie.
Yeah.
But to be able to maintain a continuum of a writing career since 1980, blah, blah. And I look up and you know, there's 15 books there and the one shelf doesn't hold them. And I look at all those pages and I think, really? Really? It just seems, I don't understand how it all happened. You know, it all blends together, but I don't remember all the effort and all the grunting and the lifting and the pushing the boulder uphill. But it's a nice feeling when you see a shelf of books with your name on them. Hey, right, Leonard?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, well, it certainly pleases my ego, although I sometimes look at that shelf or shelves and say, is anybody reading books anymore?
It's funny, but yes, they are. Yes, they are. Usually it's odd. Generally, I sell a lot more books than I do eBooks. With the Cary Grant, I'm selling a lot more eBooks. I'm not sure why, but for instance, the John Wayne sold a lot of books, hardcover, and continues to sell in paperback very well. And the eBook sales were minor, throw-ins actually. This, for some reason, the Cary Grant book is selling a lot more eBooks, and I don't know if that has to do with the way people perceive individual stars. The people who love John Wayne want the book, you know, because that's the book they're going to be on the shelf, and they're going to look at it when they watch North to Alaska or The Searchers or whatever movie they're going to watch. Whereas Cary Grant's more casual. I don't know. All I know is that the publishing industry is not going anywhere. It looked dangerous there for a while. But COVID hasn't really impacted it. Yeah, people are buying books.
No, I think COVID may be responsible for some of those ebook sales.
Possibly. But I've never been very big on ebooks at all. Most of the books sell in on print. But for some reason, this book's moving a lot of ebooks.
Yeah. We're very much. I love holding something.
Yeah, me too.
I love holding a book.
Never read a book on a digital device. Never.
And we should mention that.
Waft away.
Yeah. I'm the same way.
You mentioned that one of the things you've been doing for several decades is reviewing books for the Palm Beach Post.
Yeah, I still do for the Wall Street Journal occasionally. I do 3 or 4 reviews a year for the Wall Street Journal. Mm-hmm. Movie books. In fact, I've got a column in the Journal on Saturday. Their book page runs on Saturday. I don't know if it's late this month. I don't know if it's the 22nd or the 28th, but it's the 5 best film books ever read. 5 best film books ever written. And out of modesty, wow, I had to leave myself off. no Scott Iman in there. No Scott Iman books in there. You know, but that was.
Well, fun. Then it's a little imbalanced. A little imbalanced, I would
say. Yeah. False modesty.
It's all right. He makes up for whatever you don't write for you, because that's I laugh because there are certain, it's a funny thing, but there are certain people that I read their names more than I see. I don't know the last time I saw you, Scott, but
it's been a while.
But I'm because I run his website and I post everything, I'm always reading your name anytime he's writing, you know. And Scott Iman says,
well, that's nice to hear. I'm glad. I'm glad anytime anybody notices me at all. Because, you know, I have a cottage on my property here, like you used to have in Toluca Lake, you know?
Yeah.
You know, you had that whole room, that huge, that beautiful room, crammed with books in your desk and all that. I have a smaller cottage. It used to be the cook's cottage for the house. And I converted it into my office. And I shudder to think of what percentage of my life has been spent in that small cottage. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's in a sense, it's a very claustrophobic existence, you know, but on the other hand, there's 15 books on a shelf. So I've had a life. I mean, we travel a lot. We've got all these animals. I've got friends. You know.
I've been watching your cat behind you this entire time.
That's Myrna. That's Myrna. Named after Myrna Loy, because she's
of course.
Lady. Betty, on the other hand, is just a hellion from the center of the earth. that's why we named her after Betty Davis.
There you mm-hmm. go.
Betty and Myrna, they're sisters. They're bonded sisters. Totally different personalities.
I love it.
But it's the trade-off you make if you're essentially define yourself by what you do as opposed to what you are. You know, and I think I've probably defined myself by what I do.
So but I think that when every project takes as long as it takes, that sort of, it makes sense. You know, it's not something, in the same way that a filmmaker, you know, people who are not in the industry may not understand how long a movie takes from the writing and the rewriting and the rewriting and the rewriting to the selling, to the making. It's a huge,
Then looking for someone to give you the money to make it.
Every single piece. So when we hear, you know, from a filmmaker, it was 10 years. Mm-hmm. That's normal. I mean, it doesn't surprise me at all.
Right.
And so when you speak to, and having grown up with so many authors, and I know that if there's one book a year, that is fast.
Oh,
you know, that's quick.
I couldn't possibly do a book a year. That's no. I didn't even think about that. A book, the longest was 4. That took 6 years. Mayor was 5. That was on me. I should have done it in 4, but my first draft of the Mayor book was 1,200 pages. And then it took me a year to edit it, just to cut
sure.
and then make new connections and then cut, make new connections. It was a nightmare, and it was my own fault because I lost sight of my goal. That's the only time that's ever happened to me, though. That's the only time. I go in having a rough idea of how long the book's going to be.
Yeah.
And sometimes I miss it. I go over, but as long as the narrative works, as long as the story holds, I don't worry about it. You know, that's where your trusted readers come in, which is Lynn and my editor at Simon & Schuster, Bob Bender. Because a writer, when you write one of these books, it's 3 or 4 years, you descend into a well and you don't really come up until you come up with the manuscript. And at that point, you're way too close to it, because by the time you're through with it, you're sick to death of it. It's like you've been on the road with the same script for 3 years. You know every laugh, you know every pause, you know the audience reaction. So it's not funny to you anymore. The jokes aren't funny anymore.
Yeah.
The drama isn't moving anymore. So the response of people you trust is crucial. and you can't interpose your ego between what you want to hear and what you actually do hear. So the response from readers that you know you can trust is crucial. So I'm happy to have an edit from Robert Gottlieb or Bob Bender or Lynn Calvert, you know, because I trust them and they've never failed me yet.
But it's that ego that you talk about. Something I always compliment my dad. He's really good about taking editing notes and not taking it personally. And I think that, and whenever I speak to people about what it is to be edited, because I'm one of his readers, you know, it's understanding that it's not about you. It's nothing against you. Is this playing the way you mean for it to? Is this coming across? Because you have all the context, you know, you, the author, know everything around it. So you know what you're trying to say. And sometimes it works and sometimes it comes across perfectly. And other times you just need to mess with it a little bit, and that's okay.
What I find I do, and this is intentional on my part, I want to create the ecosystem around my central character. So I spend time with their friends to why did they relate to this person or that person? You know, why were they close with these people? Because that tells you a lot. The kind of people that your characters have for intimate friends tells you a lot about their character, of the character. So I tend to kind of work in concentric circles to bring other people into the story, which a lot of writers don't. A lot of writers don't do that. And I have to be careful about that, because there are times, I think, when I get too, there's too much of that and I have to pull it back. I rarely have to pull back on stuff dealing with the actual subject, but I occasionally pull back on the peripheral people that they're involved with, that have relations with. On the Cary Grant book, a friend of mine said, "You got too much on Clifford Odets." I said, "How much should I cut?" He said, "Take a trowel and hack." And I did. I cut a good hunk out of the Clifford Odets stuff. But I found the relationship just fascinating, because you wouldn't have thought they would have had anything to say to each other. They're such different characters. Odets was so literary and so theatrical. And Grant was not particularly theatrical or literary. But they were very, very close. And I think the bond was, they were both fundamentally dissatisfied with themselves. So they saw a commonality in each of them saw a commonality in the other. Yeah. And that's often what draws people together.
And Odets wrote None But the Lonely Heart, which was
directed
one of Cary Grant's few totally serious films.
Which I think is a seriously underrated movie. I think I don't think it's a great movie, but I think it's a very good movie.
Does Lynn have a favorite of your books?
Do you have a favorite of my books?
The Grant?
Why? Why Cary Grant?
Because he's just so ugly.
No, but there's a
book. I get it.
No, when I read the book, the first time the first read through, I told him, and he doesn't let me read it until he's done. Mm-hmm. I think this is going to be as big or bigger than your John Wayne. And it's a big person, but also it was just such a complete, you know, a complete picture. And I didn't know most of that stuff about Grant. And so I like it the best. It just stuck with me more, I think. I liked his Speed of Sound too, about the talking revolution.
Oh, we haven't mentioned that book. A very good book.
Yeah, that gave me a real nice balloon picture of what happened and why and who was involved in it.
That's interesting. I didn't know.
Thank you, Lynn.
That was a good question. It's interesting. The more hardcore the film person, the more compliments I get on the Speed of Sound. That book has yet to earn a dime. And it's 25 years old. Seriously. It's still in the red, although I think it's probably going to go into the black this year or next. But that's the book I get actually the most compliments on, is Speed of Sound.
Interesting.
And I still, it's really funny, because it sold the least of all my books, but it's the one that seems to appeal to the hardcore film people.
Well, we'll give it another plug. The Speed of Sound is a wonderful book about the transition period from the silent era to the talkie era. And it was written at a time, as Scott says, when you could actually have conversations with people who were there.
Yep.
Who experienced it. like our mutual friend Edward Burns,
who was a
tremendous, great guy and a tremendous resource.
He sent me cassettes. He sent me cassettes of him, of Ed talking about Coquette and Mary Pickford, and the problems they had wiring the United Artists studio for sound. You know, 3 or 4 60-minute cassettes, and he was great. He was a lovely man.
Yes, he sure was. Well, Scott, again, congratulations on the Cary Grant book, A Brilliant Disguise, published by Simon & Schuster, available wherever books are sold. That's virtually or in real life.
Yes.
I'm available wherever books are sold, actually. There you go. If I have a book out, I'll go anywhere.
And I recommend all of Scott's books, and they're all... they're all great reading, and I learn from them, and which is a wonderful combination. And we're talking over Zoom, so we can see a cameo appearance by
hello Betty,
Betty Davis the cat,
scary cat,
and Myrna's just back there living her very best cat life.
Myrna is just a joy. She's just blissed out and not aggressive and pleasant, and likes everybody. Whereas Betty orders everybody around.
That sounds like our two.
Yeah, yeah.
Sounds
yeah.
exactly like our dogs.
Yeah, they have nothing in common but they're sisters. What are you going to do?
Yeah.
Same.
Yeah.
Thank you guys. This has been a lot of fun. Just the conversation between friends.
No, same here. Same here. Are you a social mediaite?
I tap in now and then.
If people want to follow you, is there a place they do that?
Sure. Sure. Ask you.
Yeah. Yeah, Twitter, it's at Scott Iman numeral one. And on Facebook, he has his own Facebook page, a professional
page. Scott, perfect. E-Y-M-A-N, Scott, two T's.
Scott, take care of yourselves.
You too, boss. Thank you
and
so much.
And give my love to Alice.
We will.
We will, absolutely. And Jesse, where do people find us?
I am at Jesse Malton. You are at Leonard Malton on Twitter and Instagram. And you can always go to leonardmalton.com for movie reviews, book roundups, and all kinds of good stuff.
And we are also on Patreon.
Maltreon.
Where people generously support what we do at different levels. And we are grateful for every one of those folks because they keep us going in a very literal sense. So that's Patreon.com/Malton on Movies. Patreon.com/Malton on Movies. Folks, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Today's episode of Malton on Movies is brought to you by Legion M, the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. If you love movies as much as we do, why not own a piece of them? Find out more at www.legionm.com.